Good day. Today is Monday, 1st December 2025. And before I proceed with this program, let me remind you again to tick the like button. And if once you've watched this program, you've liked this program, and or whichever part of the program you've watched, and you want to indicate that fact. Well, let us with more ado now get to the topics that I'm going to discuss in this program, and they're going to be again mostly about the conflict in Ukraine, in fact almost entirely so. But let me say quickly a few things about the situation in around Venezuela. There's been more reports about a contentious conversation that President Trump had with President Maduro of Venezuela a couple of days ago. I think it is widely, universally accepted that President Trump, over the course of that call, demanded President Maduro's resignation. Obviously, Maduro did not agree because he is still president of Venezuela, and there is no word that he has agreed. But there have been all kinds of reports circulating in the US media, some of which say that he agreed to retire or give up his position as president of Venezuela in a year and a half's time. Other reports that he agreed to give up his position as president of Venezuela on condition that he was provided guarantees for his protection and that of his family, and that similar guarantees and pardons would be provided to other senior Venezuelan officials and their families, with Trump apparently rejecting all of these requests. I'm going to say straight away that I am deeply sceptical about these reports. Of course, I was not listening in on the call, but to me, they look like attempts by some people in the United States to spread stories that suggest that President Maduro has all but given up. This before a single shot has been fired. Anyway, let's wait and see what happens. I'm not going to pretend otherwise, half expecting after the announcement by President Trump of what amounts to a no-fly zone over Venezuela, that some military action would be taken over the preceding hours. Nothing like that has happened so far. Indeed, I understand that airlines, commercial airlines for the moment, continuing to make flights to Venezuela, which suggests that they're not taking this warning from Trump particularly seriously, though I'm not absolutely sure that I believe these reports. Anyway, we will see. We will get more information, no doubt, over the next couple of days. I am somewhat baffled that the United States is taking so long to make a decision, one way or the other, about whether to initiate military action. But to repeat again what I've said many times, if you're going to concentrate 7 missile destroyers and an aircraft carrier in close to the territory of a particular country, if you do that in combination with all kinds of threats against the government of that country, then it is very difficult for me to see how you can pull back from conducting military action without suffering a total loss of face. And I cannot imagine that this president will allow that, President Trump will allow that to happen. Anyway, we will see what happens over the next couple of days. Anyway, let us now return to the topic of what the ongoing topic of the conflict in Ukraine. And yesterday, the Ukrainians had a meeting with the Americans, apparently in Miami. The most detailed account of the meeting has been provided by Axios, the Axios portal. The meeting was apparently, according to Axios, intense. Secretary Rubio has said that the meeting was difficult but constructive. The Ukrainians have also said that it was a difficult but positive meeting. Well, when given the choice between words like difficult and constructive and positive, anybody can take their choice about which is the most important of those words. But I would pick difficult. It seems to me that no substantive progress over the course of this discussion was made at all, or at least not progress as the Russians would understand that term. Moreover, it appears that the meeting apparently got bogged down on discussions of the territorial issue. In other words, whether Ukraine should withdraw from Donbass, and that Rubio, or at least someone, then took the decision that the meeting needed to be restricted to a smaller format. And the result was that the meeting continued with just three people on the American side, Rubio, Witkoff and Kushner, and they were up against three Ukrainian officials: Umerov, the chief negotiator, Gnatov, the chief of the general staff, and interestingly, Vadim Skibitsky, who is the deputy head of the main intelligence directorate of the Ukrainian Defense Ministry. Now, the interesting thing for me about this lineup, the Ukrainian lineup, is that there is one conspicuous absence from it, and that is Kirill Budanov. Now, Kirill Budanov, who is Ukraine's military intelligence chief, as far as I know, he is Skibitsky's boss. Anyway, he was part of this delegation that was being sent by Ukraine to meet the Americans in Florida. But it appears that he was not one of the select group of three that met with the Americans. And given that he is an important intelligence official, to put it mildly, I wonder why. It seems to me that Umerov and Gnatov, the chief of the general staff, don't trust Budanov and don't want him in these small format meetings. Probably they feel that Budanov has been getting too close to the Americans. And of course, they know, probably they always knew, but they now definitely know that Budanov has had a back channel to the Russians. He's been meeting them in Abu Dhabi. We know that because the US Assistant Secretary for War, Dan Driscoll, recently gatecrashed a meeting, thereby making the fact of that meeting between Budanov and Russian intelligence officers public. And of course, Budanov has recently taken to making all sorts of comments about the state of the war, which I know many people in Ukraine are unhappy about, because they consider them to be unduly pessimistic. So anyway, whatever the reason, Budanov was not involved in this meeting. And we're then told that the meeting continued, that there were again intense discussions, and then after this meeting of three versus three, there was yet another meeting, this time between Umerov and Witkoff. In other words, Witkoff decided that he would speak directly with Umerov, again cutting out all of the others. And that following this meeting, the meeting between Umerov and Witkoff, Umerov got on the telephone and reported to Zelensky. Now, to me, that looks as if on the issue of territory, of the issue of Ukraine's withdrawal from Donbass specifically, which appears to be the issue that the Americans are trying to pursue, the Americans ran into opposition from the Ukrainians. And they hoped, they therefore presumably suggested a meeting in restricted format. They got Umerov, Gnatov and Skibitsky on their own, and they tried to put more pressure on them to agree to withdraw, to have the Ukrainians withdraw from Donbass. And this also was unsuccessful. And that Witkoff, who is the person who has perhaps proposed, was the first to propose in discussions with the Russians that the Ukrainians should withdraw from Donbass, then made a last attempt to get the Ukrainians to come round. And he had a one-to-one meeting with Umerov. And it doesn't seem as if that meeting went very far either. But anyway, Umerov then telephoned Zelensky and presumably sought instructions also from Zelensky. And the best guess is that Zelensky dug in his heels and refused to countenance withdrawal from Donbass. And we have not heard much about the other big issue, which is Ukraine's NATO membership. But the various reports say that the Ukrainians are digging in their heels about this also. They have apparently been prepared to explore with the Americans some avenues of how to get round this issue. I'm not quite sure what that means, but they have adamantly refused, apparently, to countenance any changes to their constitution which commits Ukraine to joining NATO. Whatever schemes the Americans propose, whatever ideas they float for blocking Ukraine's membership into NATO for the indefinite future, I'm going to make a guess, in fact, more than a guess, I'm going to say with full confidence that I don't expect the Russians to be persuaded by any such schemes. If the commitment for Ukraine to join NATO is still in Ukraine's constitution, the Russians will say that this matter is unresolved and that the whole question of Ukrainian membership on that basis, the whole question of Ukrainian settlement, the settlement of the conflict, cannot proceed. Of course, the Russians also know that a few months ago, Zelensky himself signed off on a treaty with Britain, which both Britain and Ukraine have just recently ratified. And one of the clauses of this treaty says that Ukraine is on an irreversible path towards NATO. And that continues to be the position of the NATO Secretariat, of Mark Rutte. And it is also the position of the various other key European governments. So the Russians are almost certainly going to reject outright whatever scheme trying to get round this issue the Ukrainians and the Americans might have discussed with each other in Florida. So it seems to me that the meeting did not go well. And I've seen pictures of Witkoff in particular, and he looked tired and I thought rather depressed, actually. And I noticed that shortly after this meeting, President Trump was asked questions about the direction of the Ukrainian settlement discussions. He said that the Ukrainians are having all sorts of problems. He suggested that these problems might be connected with the ongoing corruption scandal in Kiev, which, by the way, you could take as a signal that the Americans are not involved in the corruption scandal. But then it's perhaps unwise to place too much weight on what President Trump says about these matters. But beyond that, President Trump also gave the impression that he's not placing any specific date on when he expects the Ukrainian settlement to be agreed. It's perhaps worth pointing out here that 10 days ago, there were a lot of reports that President Trump had given Zelensky some kind of ultimatum, that Zelensky needed to accept the 28 points without demur, and that if he didn't, then the United States would stop providing Ukraine with intelligence information and would stop all weapons deliveries to Ukraine. I said that I thought that was a mistake when that threat was apparently made. I said that the Ukrainians would undoubtedly see that as a bluff. I said that I didn't think the Ukrainians would believe that the Americans really would cut off intelligence assistance and would indeed stop military aid. And if you notice, nobody in the media is talking about this deadline any longer. It has clearly been passed, and the intelligence assistance is still being provided, and the Americans are still supplying weapons to Ukraine, only they have to be bought for Ukraine by the Europeans. So the Ukrainians called President Trump's bluff, and well, now Trump, perhaps more sensibly, is saying that he's setting no deadlines and is waiting to see where this process is going to go from here. Well, Witkoff and Kushner are now travelling to Moscow. I understand that Rubio is not coming with them. And as I've discussed in previous programmes, in the absence of Rubio, I have significant doubts about whether the US government is really committed to this process. Because Rubio, after all, is the Secretary of State. He is the person who ought to be leading in these negotiations with the Russians. The fact that he's not going to Moscow, that he is not meeting with Putin and Lavrov and Ushakov and all of the others, I think it's the clearest possible signal that he doesn't really believe in this process. He's going through the motions of fulfilling the president's policy of trying to agree a settlement with the Russians. But he clearly doesn't want to go to Moscow. He doesn't want to be seen in the Russian capital. He probably worries that that wouldn't go down well with his neocon friends in the Senate, which, of course, he was a member of until, well, just 10 months ago. And I don't think he wants to be in any position where he negotiates with the Russians and appears to be making concessions to them. So Rubio, it seems, is not going. There's no word about whether Dan Driscoll is going either. At the moment, it looks as if it's just going to be Witkoff and Kushner. And, well, at this point, the Russians are going to ask themselves, inevitably, this question. Who exactly are these people? Witkoff is not an official of the US government. He is a businessman who is a friend of the President of the United States. he is authorized by the President of the United States to conduct negotiations on behalf of the President and of his, and indeed of the United States itself. But the very fact that he is outside the US government must call into question his ability to speak for it. And as for Jared Kushner, the Russians know quite a lot about Kushner. They know that he is, well, I understand that they believe him to be a very intelligent man and one who is extremely well informed about many issues. And he is clearly friends with the president and therefore influential. After all, he is the president's son-in-law. But he too is not an official, as I understand it, of the US government. He has no formal role within the government. Witkoff doesn't, Kushner doesn't. And yet it is they that the United States is sending to Moscow at this time. Now, the reports from Moscow say that Witkoff and Kushner are going to meet Putin tomorrow afternoon, and that the discussions in Moscow are going to take place then. But it seems to me that the Americans are again coming to Moscow empty-handed. Lavrov has previously told us in various press conferences and interviews he has given about the meeting in Alaska, that over the course of the meeting in Alaska, Putin discussed with Witkoff and Trump the various talking points that the Americans said that they wanted to discuss with the Russians in formal negotiations leading towards an eventual settlement of the conflict. And Putin asked Witkoff and Trump whether they expected that Zelensky and the Europeans would accept this and whether they would fall into line. And Trump supposedly trolled Putin. We have this from Lavrov. Trump told Putin, yes, he was confident that he would be able to get the Ukrainians and the Europeans to sign up and to agree to all of this. And, well, we see that that hasn't happened. There was the meeting in August, the various meetings in August, when Zelensky turned up in Washington with all of the European leaders in tow, and they had various meetings with Trump, but Zelensky dug in his heels and rejected all question of withdrawal from Donbass and insisted that Ukraine was holding its own and in fact winning. And the Europeans all supported him on this, and the Europeans also supported Zelensky on the question of Ukraine's NATO membership. Anyway, that all happened in August. And then the Russians began to get increasingly infuriated and impatient because Trump wasn't getting back to them on what he said he would do in Alaska, which is to get the Ukrainians and the Europeans on side. And of course, the Russians follow the media and they notice all the belligerent and confrontational language coming out of Kiev and coming out of Europe, and they apparently then sent a letter, a memo to the Americans asking what is the progress, what progress has President Trump made, and that memo apparently triggered the decision by the Americans, by Witkoff and Trump, to set up the telephone call with Putin that took place a few weeks ago on the eve of Zelensky's visit to Washington. And it seems that over the course of that telephone call, Trump assured Putin all over again that he would get Zelensky's agreement in the meeting he was going to have with Zelensky on the following day. And Trump met Zelensky, and the American media have told us that the meeting went badly wrong, that voices rose, that there was bad language used, that Trump threw Zelensky's maps onto the floor or the table or something like that. But Zelensky stuck to his ground. He didn't give way. And in the end, it was Trump who gave way. He gave way. He said that he agreed with Zelensky after all, that the ceasefire needed to be on the current conflict lines. And he, following that, called off the summit meeting that he'd agreed, and in fact proposed to Putin, which would have happened in Budapest. And he gave the green light for Scott Bessent and the Treasury Department to impose sanctions on Lukoil and Rosneft. And the Russians have not bent, and they've not changed their stance in any way. And then the news came of the Russian breakthroughs on the front lines, and Witkoff had more meetings with Dmitriev and came up with his 28 points, which bring us back, in effect, full circle to Alaska, though with some modifications apparently. And we see that the Americans have tried all over again to get the immovable obstacle, Zelensky and the Ukrainians, to move, but the immovable obstacle remains in place, and it continues to have the support of the Europeans. And by the way, on that, Zelensky has acted in his typical manner, because even as Umerov and the others were in Florida having their meeting with Rubio and Witkoff and Kushner, Zelensky himself was off to France, and he's currently meeting with his dear friend Emmanuel Macron, the president of France. And we again see lots of photos. The French president and Macron and his officials apparently not in any way put off by the corruption scandal in Kiev, the revelation that there's been enormous corruption in Ukraine. Full of smiles, greeting Zelensky. I haven't actually seen pictures of Macron hugging Zelensky. That's what Starmer does. But again, you can see that they're very happy to have Zelensky there. And they're, again, very happy to give Zelensky full, unswerving support, or so they say. And whatever, the point is that with all of this, this appearance of support from the French, well, it signals two things. It signals to people back in Kiev who might be saying to themselves, well, we've managed to get rid of Zelensky's all-powerful chief of staff, Andrei Yermak. Let's have a go against Zelensky himself. But now they see that the French, the Europeans, continue to back Zelensky, and that inevitably is going to have a dampening effect in Kiev on the corruption investigations, at least insofar as they affect Zelensky himself. So it's an endorsement of Zelensky as president of Ukraine, despite the corruption investigations. And, well, of course, at the same time, it's a signal to Zelensky himself that he can go on defying the Americans on territorial issues, on NATO membership, on the size of Ukraine's armed forces. And he has the full backing of the French, the Germans, the British, the European Commission, all the key players in Europe. They're all with him all the way on this one. And presumably when Umerov picked up the telephone and reported to Zelensky after his meeting with Witkoff. Zelensky took the call whilst he was in France. For all I know, whilst he was in the Elysee, and the French would have been there, Macron and his wife, by the way, and all of the other key officials, and they would have all been there, and they would have been there to give Zelensky all the reassurance and all of the support that he needed in this hour when he might have felt that he needed this support in light of the pressure he was coming under from the Americans. So anyway, the immovable obstacle, and to repeat again, the corruption scandal itself in Ukraine, whoever is behind it, whether it was the Americans, whether it was someone in Europe, though I can't see how it would be someone in Europe, given that the Europeans have spoken out against it, or, as I still tend to believe, mostly at least, Zelensky's opponents in Kiev, the corruption scandal is symptomatic of a crisis of confidence in Kiev as information trickles in of the collapse of the front lines, and as it becomes increasingly clear that the Europeans are running into massive obstacles in the way of their 140 billion euro loan, which was supposed to be secured against the Russian sovereign assets. But in spite of that, it's important to remember that whatever the purpose of this scandal, whether it's intended to remove Zelensky himself from the presidency or marginalise him, reduce him to some kind of ceremonial role, or simply get Zelensky to remove all the officials around him and to replace them with officials from the opposition. There is a lot of talk in Kiev about creating a government of national unity in this great moment of crisis. But of course, a government of national unity will be made up of all of the old gang, Poroshenko, Klitschko, Tymoshenko, and all of them. And that will put them in a better position where they can appropriate all of the funding, such a funding as continues to flow from Europe before the final end comes. Whatever happens as a result of the corruption scandal, there is no one in Kiev, no one in the political system in Ukraine who seems to me both interested or willing or politically able to take a different line on the settlement of the conflict from the one that Zelensky is taking. Anyone who replaces Zelensky, be it the Speaker of the Parliament on an acting basis, or Tymoshenko, or Klitschko, or Poroshenko, or Zelensky, is going to take exactly the same line. They're going to refuse to withdraw from Donbass. They're going to refuse to give up on NATO membership. They're going to refuse to change the constitution. There is no reason to think that any of them are going to change their stance on anything. One of those people, General Zelensky, has now published an article in the Daily Telegraph. I say published an article, though, as my friend and colleague Alex Cristoforo correctly says, the article that was published in the Daily Telegraph, if you read it, is obviously not written by Zelensky. It's written by someone else, someone I would guess who is drawn from the British state, the British institutions, the deep state, if you like, here in London, which, of course, supports Ukraine, fervently supports Ukraine, and which has a good relationship with Zelensky, who is, of course, now Ukraine's ambassador to London. Zeluzhny, if you like, has always been the insurance the British have taken out on Ukraine in the event that Zelensky is forced out. The British, and they're not the only people, the British, but also the Europeans, perhaps some of the Europeans too, are telling themselves that Zeluzhny would be the perfect person to put in his place. He's on friendly terms with the far-right brigades, the nationalist brigades in Ukraine. He's got support from those circles. He's previously had a fairly cordial relationship with the former president Poroshenko. He is popular with many of the soldiers in the army, and he's exactly the right person to continue exactly the same policy as the one that Zelensky has followed, only he will do so with a perhaps more conventional image and in a more popular way. And if we go back to this article, which has appeared over Zeluzhny's name in the Daily Telegraph, well, I read it carefully. It makes some admissions that the situation on the battlefronts is not going particularly well for Ukraine. It concedes that the Ukrainian offensive of 2023 was not successful, and it concedes that 2023 and 2024 were difficult years for Ukraine, but it still talks about how Ukraine can achieve victory. It still looks for ways to preserve Ukraine, but to preserve Ukraine in a way that would preserve it, to renew the conflict. To me, having read it, frankly, it looked like another attempt to refloat the formula associated with General Kellogg of a freeze of the conflict on the existing conflict lines. So there is no one in Kiev who is going to deviate fundamentally from the position that Zelensky is taking. So that then brings us back to the purpose of Witkoff's and Kushner's trip to Moscow, which is taking place today, but over the course of which they are likely to meet Putin tomorrow afternoon. And, well, I doubt that this meeting will be as long as the previous meetings, because a lot of the ground has been trodden already. I've pointed out in recent programs that the Russians have been communicating in no uncertain ways that they made all the concessions that they're prepared to make and that they're not prepared to make more. We've had statements to this effect from Ryabkov, the deputy foreign minister, and by the way, Lavrov and Medvedev, who's also been sticking his oar in recently, making his own positions clear. And of course, we've had Putin's own words in Bishkek. The Russians have indicated that the original 28-point points were a potential basis for negotiations and discussions. They've made it very clear that they're not signed up to any one of them, but they are prepared to talk on the basis of them. They've also made it very clear that if they get proposals for discussions that deviate significantly from what was previously agreed by Putin and Trump in Alaska, well, then they're simply not interested. I am going to guess that Kushner and Witkoff understand this, that they're going to go to Moscow, that they're going to tell Putin that it's still a work in progress with the Ukrainians. In fact, it is not a work in progress. The Ukrainians are a brick wall that the Americans cannot get past. But anyway, they're going to say that to the Russians. And they're going to say, let's begin a substantive negotiation anyway. And, well, possibly, maybe, just maybe, the Russians will agree and they will say, OK, let's have a substantive negotiation. But it will be one in which we bring up the points that concern us. And Putin has already made it clear that it will be a negotiation led by the foreign ministry. In other words, Lavrov will appoint the chief negotiator, who will be an official of the foreign ministry. I'm guessing, by the way, that it will be Ryabkov, but it could be someone else, and I'm not going to say definitely that it will be Ryabkov. And the Russians will say that it must be a bilateral negotiation between Russia and the United States, though they may agree to hold negotiations in parallel with the Ukrainians alongside. There are, of course, negotiations in theory underway with the Ukrainians. There have been three meetings in Istanbul. Vladimir Medinsky is the chief Russian negotiator in those talks. Umerov is the chief Ukrainian negotiator in those talks too. The Russians have made proposals to upgrade the status of the delegations and to set up three working parties. The Ukrainians have never responded to that. It's unlikely that they ever will. But the Russians might say, OK, let's begin our own negotiations. Those negotiations between Russia and the United States. And if the Ukrainians want to conduct negotiations, resume the negotiations in parallel with our negotiations with the United States, then of course they're welcome to, and that the proposals that we made several months ago for the setting up of the three working parties and for the upgrading of the negotiating teams, well, those of course still stand. Now that may sound complicated, but it is not very much more complicated or different from what has happened in previous wars. So over the Paris talks that ended American involvement in the Vietnam War, the North Vietnamese negotiated with the Americans, Le Duc Tho with Henry Kissinger, mostly, though actually the delegation heads were different. And, of course, the South Vietnamese were also present, though they were present, or rather they participated, though they were obviously overshadowed by the talks, the really important talks, which were the talks between the United States and North Vietnam. And something not entirely different happened in the talks that took place in Doha between the United States and the Taliban. The Afghan government of President Al-Ghani was also invited to the table. It never really showed up, but it was not excluded either. So it's not so different. There is one fundamental difference, however, between this conflict and the conflicts in Vietnam and in Afghanistan. And that difference is this, that the United States military had a military presence, an open military presence in Vietnam and in Afghanistan. The North Vietnamese and the Taliban knew that they could not win the war unless they persuaded the United States to leave. The purpose of the negotiations in Paris and Doha, from the perspective of the North Vietnamese and of the Taliban, was to create a formula that would enable the Americans to leave. And the North Vietnamese and the Taliban probably calculated correctly, as it happens, that with the Americans gone, events in South Vietnam and in Afghanistan would ultimately play out as they wanted. I am oversimplifying. In the case of Vietnam, there was an actually very complex peace deal done, which the South Vietnamese violated, precipitating the series of events that eventually led to the collapse of South Vietnam. But I, for one, and I remember that time, always assumed that if the Americans pulled out of South Vietnam, the North Vietnamese would eventually take control. That I remember thinking at the time. I know that there were an awful lot more people who were in those days far more knowledgeable and experienced of these things than I was. Certainly then, I was a mere youth who thought exactly the same. And that was exactly how it turned out. At this time, it is different. Because though the United States is enormously heavily involved in the war, it provides weapons assistance to the Ukrainians, it provides intelligence to the Ukrainians, it guides many of the missiles that the Ukrainians launch, the ATACMS missiles and the HIMARS missiles. The United States is not itself publicly and openly involved in the conflict. And the Russians know that they're going to win regardless of what the Americans do. That all they have to do is just keep on fighting as they are fighting. And they don't have to get the Americans to exit, because the Americans are only half in. And being half in, it's enough to enable the Russians to win. So any negotiation now, given the realities of the battlefronts, is going to itself be a race against time. That the Ukrainians are only just about clinging on the front lines. In fact, their forces are crumbling. We'll discuss this further when I turn to the military situation. But with every day, every week that passes, Ukraine gets weaker and weaker. The Russians get stronger and stronger. So if there is a formal negotiation in the kind of formal format that Putin and the Russians envisage, with plenary sessions and discussions and that kind of thing, well, that kind of process takes a while, years. From memory, the Paris talks took 4 years. The Doha talks took even longer. Who genuinely believes that Ukraine is going to be able to hold out for 4 years? So the Russians, from their point of view, talks, well, they're fine with them. But as the talks progress, the Americans probably are going to find that as the situation on the front lines changes remorselessly to Russia's advantage, the talks will gradually fade away and lose their relevance, because it will be the situation on the battlefields that will, as always in this war, determine the final outcome. So this changes the picture. Now, there's been an article in the official government newspaper in Moscow, Rossiyskaya Gazeta, and it has said, I've not read the article myself, but I've seen accounts of it. It says that Russia has no interest in stopping the fighting, even if talks get underway, because it is the talks that provide Russia with leverage. And there's been some angry comments about this article in the West. An editorial in The Guardian said that this is in some way outrageous. But of course the Russians want to have leverage ahead of negotiations. They would be fools if they didn't. And that's precisely why they are not going to agree to a ceasefire. Now, what that means is that if talks between the United States and Russia on Ukraine ever get started, the pressure will always be on the Americans to make the substantive concessions. Now, a couple of months ago, that exceptional writer, Cotillia the Contemplator, published a really brilliant piece on his Substack site, in which he looked back on the previous history of negotiations by the United States and the various countries that it was pitted against. The Koreans during the Korean War, not just the Koreans, by the way, the Soviets and the Chinese were also there in those discussions too, which took place in Geneva, by the way. The North Vietnamese, and the Taliban. And the interesting point was that always at the start of the negotiations, the Americans began by basically rejecting the substantive demands made by their adversaries, the Koreans, the North Vietnamese, and the Taliban. And as the pressure on the Americans grew stronger through the events, as a result of the unfolding events, the Americans gradually shifted their position. And by the time the talks had ended, they had essentially accepted every part of the original demands that the Koreans, the North Vietnamese, and the Afghans had made. It's, again, I'm simplifying what is a much more interesting and sophisticated article than I have just said. And it's worth going back to Cotillia the Contemplator's Substack site and tracking it down and reading it. Anyway, the same sort of process would be underway if negotiations between the United States and Russia got underway. Sooner or later, sooner rather than later, Donbass will fall. The Ukrainians, the Americans will have lost further leverage. The Americans will then be pushed towards making concessions. And that is how the war would go on. The only way that pattern would change is if the Americans decided to walk away from the talks and decided to engage the Russians in massive escalation. Now, this did happen during the negotiations with the North Vietnamese and with the Taliban. The United States engaged in massive escalation, even as the Paris peace talks were underway. They expanded the war into Kampuchea, Cambodia and Laos. They carried out heavy bombing raids on Hanoi, the North Vietnamese capital. But at no point could they change the trajectory of travel, which was the one that led them in the end to accept all of the demands that the North Vietnamese had made at the start of the talks. And the same, by the way, was true in Afghanistan. I can remember that President Trump at one point started to deploy the mother of all bombs and used that in attacks on the Taliban and all of this. But in the end, whatever the Americans did, it wasn't able to change the picture. And I fully expect that if negotiations were to take place, we would have very difficult moments, the Americans would give the impression that they were prepared to walk away. There would be escalations of various kinds. But in the end, if there were negotiations, if the objective, the American objective, were to avoid a total defeat in Ukraine, the Americans would have ultimately always be drawn back, because if the Americans can escalate, so can the Russians, and it is the Russians who continue and will continue to advance on the battlefields. In my opinion, the military outcome is now become so clear. The pace of the Russian advance is so fast. Even the Institute for the Study of War, by the way, has now admitted that this November was the second fastest month of Russian advance since Ukraine began its counteroffensives in the autumn of 2022. The previous fastest month of Russian advance, for the record, was October 2024. Anyway, the pace of the Russian advance is so fast and it is becoming so meaningful that I think that there is a real possibility that Ukraine will collapse long before any negotiation is concluded. I wonder, given that this is so, whether the Americans ultimately will agree to negotiate at all. After all, Rubio's absence suggests that they're not united behind this. The administration is not united behind this. And we know that the deep state in the United States, the Senate, the Europeans are all adamantly hostile. Anyway, we will see what they do. But one way or the other, it seems to me that Witkoff and Kushner are going to Moscow, are going to meet Putin tomorrow, and they're going to come empty-handed. They might ask the Russians for negotiations, because perhaps that's what the president still wants. The Russians probably will agree. But the negotiations, if they take place, will work to the Russians' advantage, because it is the Russians who hold the initiative on the battlefronts. Anyway, we shall see what takes place tomorrow. It's going to be an interesting week. After the meeting with Kushner and Witkoff, Putin flies on to Delhi, where he's going to have his big meeting with Prime Minister Modi. All kinds of packages have been put together, all sorts of deals have been done, put together for the Russians and the Indians to sign off. Obviously, that'll be an important trip, and I will discuss it in more detail on this channel when it happens. But anyway, we shall see. Now, in the meantime, events on the battlefields continue, and the pace continues to grow, get faster and faster. Now, there has been a very strange, very indicative development over the last 24 hours, which is that the Russian Defense Ministry has now published its daily update of the situation on the battlefronts. And I noticed that for the first time in many weeks, it has made no mention of anything that is taking place in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd. Now, that suggests to me that we are in a decisive moment, or at least an end point, more precisely, an endpoint moment. I've noticed that recently the Russian Defense Ministry has been publishing eyewitness accounts from Russian commanders of the fighting in Pokrovsk and Mirnograd, and rather disturbingly, and I should say clearly that I don't approve of this. They've also been publishing interviews with Ukrainian soldiers who have been taken prisoner in the Pokrovsk, Mirnograd area. When that tends to happen, it's usually a sign, or it has been a sign, that a particular battle is coming to an end. That was true of the battle for Kupiansk, for example. And the last piece of news we got, which was yesterday from the Russian Defense Ministry, was that the Russians have captured more territory in southern and central Mirnograd, and that they are clearing the Dinas micro-district in the northern part of Pokrovsk, and that the Russian army has now entered the important village of Gryshino. And I did wonder whether the fact that the Russian army has entered Gryshino meant that Ukrainian defense in Pokrovsk, the Ukrainian forces in Pokrovsk that were still there, basically such resistance as there was there has now finally collapsed, releasing Russian troops to advance further into Gryshino. And the fact that the Russian Defense Ministry is no longer providing us information about the situation in Pokrovsk could be a sign that resistance in Pokrovsk, Ukrainian resistance in Pokrovsk, has effectively ended, and that in the next couple of days, sometime in the next couple of days, or even hours, the Russian Defense Ministry will announce the fall of Pokrovsk. And they could be preparing to do that in precisely the time when Witkoff and Kushner arrive in Moscow. Anyway, we will see. I mean, it could be that there are other reasons. It could be that there isn't very much to report, or it could be that the person who writes up the reports has taken leave. Who knows? But my own sense is that we are indeed now coming to the end here, definitely now. And this is a strong tell sign that that is the case. There has been other very interesting news in this general area about the fighting in Donbass. Firstly, as I discussed in a number of programs a short time ago, it looks as if the Russians have mostly cleared the village of Shahovo, and there are reports that they have also advanced into the village of Sofievka, which is also located somewhere in this region, close to Shahovo, northeast of Pokrovsk, in the area where the Russians recently achieved their breakthrough. But perhaps the most interesting thing is that the Russians today have announced that their forces advancing towards Konstantinovka and the Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka, Slavyansk conurbation from the east have captured the village of Klinovoye, which is, as the Russian Defense Ministry says, deep inside Ukrainian positions. Now, this is a dramatic development, and it happens. It's taken place in a completely different, on the other side, if you like, of the on the eastern side of the Slavyansk, Kramatorsk, Konstantinovka conurbation. Pokrovsk is on the western side, and Sofievka and Shahovo are, of course, also on the western side. But Klinovoye is on the eastern side. It is, in fact, reached. The Russians presumably have reached it by advancing from Chasiv Yar. And the point about Klinovoye is that it is a village quite close to the important town of Druzhkovka. Druzhkovka lies between Konstantinovka and Kramatorsk. It's not a small place, by the way. It's a town of about 50,000 people. And Klinovoye is quite close to Druzhkovka. If you look at a map, it's, well, I won't say it's a suburb of Druzhkovka, but the distance between Druzhkovka and Klinovoye is not big. So, if you look at the situation on a map, the Russians, perhaps about to announce the capture of Pokrovsk, which, by the way, to make this absolutely clear, they have been in essential control of for about a month now. I mean, the fighting that has been taking place in Pokrovsk has been a basically mopping up operations, clearing up pockets of Ukrainian resistance, pockets of Ukrainian troops that were left behind as the Russians advanced and as the main body of Ukrainian troops withdrew to Mirnograd. So the Russians, about to complete the capture of Pokrovsk, the Ukrainian troops in Mirnograd surrounded and in a desperate position. The Russians again advancing in the area to the northeast of Pokrovsk, where they made their breakthrough in August. They captured Vladimirovka, apparently Shakhovko. They've entered Sofievka. The two important villages of Kucherev Yar and Zoloti Kolodyaz are still well within their reach and in fact will probably be captured fairly soon after. If you look at this whole territory, Pokrovsk, Mirnograd, Kucherev Yar, Zoloti Kolodyaz, Shakhovo, Sofievka, Rodinskaya as well, by the way, Belitskaya, which the Russians are also now moving towards. That looks like the western pincer. And the Russians, already established in Chasiv Yar, now pushing westwards and capturing Klinovoye. That looks like the eastern pincer. And the pincers, the two places where the pincers will meet, will be Druzhkovka, or perhaps the road leading south from Druzhkovka to Konstantinovka. I remember that about a week ago, when Putin met with the Russian generals, the Russian general who was in charge of the Russian forces that are fighting in South Konstantinovka said that he expected Konstantinovka to fall by mid-December. Putin said to him, don't be in too much of a hurry. There's obviously an awful lot to do. But you can start to see what is happening, because with Pokrovsk, Mirnograd falling, with all of these villages to the north of Pokrovsk, Mirnograd also falling, with the Russians now advancing eastwards from Chasiv Yar to Klinovoye, you can see that an encirclement of Konstantinovka is about to happen. So that's the next cauldron, if you like. If the Russians, of course, established positions north of Konstantinovka on the main road from Druzhkovka to Konstantinovka, then this is another massive operational crisis for the Ukrainians. And then, of course, Druzhkovka itself would presumably be the next target, and in fact would probably be another target alongside all of this. So another crisis on top of the crises that the Ukrainians are facing in Siversk and further south in Guliapolye, where there are further reports, by the way, of the Russians moving along the various roads south towards Guliapolye, cutting off its supply lines, and where there's continuing reports of further Russian advances inside the town, despite the attempts by the Ukrainians to stabilize the situation there. So, to repeat a point that I've made in recent programs, one of the other interesting facts about the pattern of Russian operations over the last few weeks, months, is that previously the Russians played this very intricate game of chess, aiming always to capture towns and positions. They would outflank the towns, they would capture the supply lines, they would then leave a route for the Ukrainians to escape, and then they would occupy the town, having limited their own casualties. Now they're not doing this. They are closing the supply routes, but they are leaving no routes for the Ukrainians to escape. They are, in other words, busy creating cauldrons, and they're doing this much more systematically than they have done at any earlier point in the war since 2022. So we've seen the cauldrons established around Kupiansk and in Pokrovsk, Mirnograd. There is a cauldron forming around Siversk, and this is another big topic which I will discuss in another program. And there is now a cauldron developing around Konstantinovka and perhaps ultimately Druzhkovka. And perhaps once these cauldrons have all done their work, the biggest cauldron of all around the cities of Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. What the Russians are now doing is that they're aiming to destroy the Ukrainian army. It's not just to capture particular cities, but to destroy the Ukrainian army in eastern Ukraine, to surround it, to defeat the brigades, to render it incapable of continuing defense. And, well, I don't know how long this process is going to take. Obviously, it will certainly take several more months, but it cannot last indefinitely. And the Russians are now strong enough, and the Ukrainians are weak enough to make this now a viable strategy. So that brings me back to the point about the negotiations. How can the Ukrainians and the Americans negotiate for better terms with the Russians in whatever format of negotiations now starts, assuming that one does even start, if not just the front lines are collapsing, but the entire Ukrainian army is being ground into the dust as well? Well, we shall see. Now, I'm going to finish this program by commenting briefly on the major Russian drone and missile strike that took place on Kiev 3 days ago. There's been a lot more information provided. It appears that, as far as I can see, the missiles and the drones got through and did all of the damage that they needed to do. I've seen no evidence that Ukrainian air defense was effective. And there's been a report in the Russian TASS news agency that says that 80% of Ukraine's energy system is now either inoperative or in crisis or in a critical condition. So add it all up. Cauldrons forming on battlefields, a crisis in the sky, the collapse of the energy system, the Europeans unable to negotiate the loan. Any attempt now to negotiate a solution to this crisis, to come to a diplomatic settlement, has come so late that perhaps it's come too late, and it might turn out that it will be overtaken by events, because the events now, the real events, are moving very fast. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and also our new Substack page. Please remember, if you want to support this channel, to do so via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel if you've liked this program. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.